How long is this tape?
Is it 60 or
45?
It's 90. Oh, that's right. Yes. Okay.
The main thing I was interested in watching, Ben, I just know you've seen quite a few, bhikkhus come and go, right?
Yeah.
Just wondered what kind of advice you had for new bhikkhus. I've just been surprised at what born. I've seen so many come and go, and well, when I was ordaining, David Panicello was just disrobing.
Yeah.
I've seen quite a few come and go now. And I don't know what it is that makes a bhikkhu and why, what it is that keeps one going, or what it is that...
I would say one of two things. One you can do nothing about, and that's kamma. And kamma is that way inclined, or that's it. It's not. There is one other thing. That the new bhikkhu should, within the first year he'd been ordained, I would say, try to get to a good teacher and work as hard as he can in samadhi. Because until one has a taste of samadhi anyway, one doesn't know the value of the Dhamma and the teaching. If a bhikkhu doesn't get towards samadhi, doesn't get any samadhi, he just gets no experience of it, and he doesn't see the value of it. And he reads the books, but paper's not very tasty food, paper and printing. And after a while, the chitta gets rather tired. And after that, one thinks, well, what am I doing this for? I'm just making difficulties for myself, and then simply getting it. So they give up the road. Whereas if a person gains samadhi, then they know the taste of that. And they know that this is right and this is good. And they've had the experience of something which is more of happiness than they've had before. And they know only that if only they can get to that and maintain that state, things are okay. So I would say the best advice for anybody who becomes ordained, get out of Bangkok as soon as you can, get to a wat where there's a good teacher, get down to the practice, do the practice as hard as you can, for a long time, and don't stop doing it. There's a great temptation in many ways to stop, to sort of, having got some experience, everyone thinks, oh, I'd like to talk about this with other people, and do that. And talk with other people all the time about it. And they all just sort of fritter it away. But the thing we've got to do is to practice, and to learn the method of not talking with other people about it. there's a well-known experience that if a person gains something, or they find out something, or they come to know something, if they share that with other people, it's as though it spreads. Now this is found with bad things very easily. If a person's got some bad things in their past, and they've got sort of guilt about it, and they're feeling very bad about it, and they don't like it, they talk with it with someone, talk about it with someone else, because it spreads. They ease it on. Well, the same thing happens in the opposite way with good things. You talk about other people, it becomes much more ordinary, and it sort of loses its taste, and goes, one doesn't feel it's so valuable. So the business of keeping these things to oneself is very important until one's got a lot of experience, until one's strong inside. So I would say the important thing is do one samadhi practice, and don't talk about it. If you gain something, some method of your own, which you find works very well, and it works for you, don't go telling other people. Not until you've had enough experience with it, that you're well used to that method, and you know it works well. Then maybe, but not until then. This is very important, I think. It's And but the important thing for a new bhikkhu is to get some experience of the practice. Because if they don't have that, there's nothing really to hold them. I mean, otherwise it's just theory and ideas and so on. They've been doing that all their life. I would say the practice, get to the practice, get to samadhi. And there must be samadhi. It's no good thinking about things. One's got to keep on to one thing, like buddho, 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 just that. Or anapana, keeping the breath here, and stopping thoughts. Stop the thoughts. Entirely. When one's got, when one's able to stop the thoughts, then one's in a position to turn to use them properly. But until one can stop one's thoughts, one hasn't got control of them, one can't control them, they go everywhere, and they're used. It's just weak. But having learnt to stop thoughts, then one can learn to put them where one wants them, and to make use of them, they become strong. So the thing is, to begin with, stop the thoughts. Learn to gain calm. People in the West need calm. They come from an environment that is a hell of a mess. And because they've been influenced by the environment, mostly they're a hell of a mess too. It takes a long time to sort of settle down and sort themselves out. And they have to realize that they haven't got very long. What I mean is they haven't got long before their kilesas start coming up and saying, hey, what are you doing here? This isn't doing any good. So they've got to work hard with it. And they've got to go to a place where they don't have all the distractions, and where they can get down to doing the practice properly. Another thing I would advise anybody who's trying to practice the samadhi, stop reading. Don't read. Particularly those news magazines and that sort. Because one has to realize whatever one reads, whatever one hears, it all goes in. All goes into the chitta. And that's food for it. And it develops in the way that food goes in. I mean, if it's food about the world, it thinks about the world, and it goes out to the world. If it's food about bad things, it goes in bad things, it thinks about bad things. Even if it's good things, it goes in and starts thinking about good things. But if one's trying to stop thoughts, none of it anymore. Not at that stage. So the best thing is stop thinking. Stop all contact and reading and so on, and talk with other people as little as possible. Keep to oneself. Keep away. Best thing, I think.
I find myself now, I don't know if it's typical for new people or just me, but I talk too much, I think. You know, about stupid things, about little petty things.
Yeah.
I realize, you know, I'm talking about it, but, you know,
yeah.
Just can't seem to. No, I have no business talking.
Yes. One should watch oneself talking and then reflect on one's talking and think, well, that talk, did that do me any good? What good did I get from it? What value was it? Did the other person get me good? And I should really think like that. I mean, we all make mistakes, I know. We all forget quite often. Most of us. Okay, all of us except the real Acharyas haven't got enough mindfulness. But one has to apply this often and often and often until it starts to have an effect. And then what happens is one thinks one's going to talk about something and one says, why? What's the point of doing? To oneself. And then the teaching is beginning to have an effect. Also, I would say for new bhikkhu, don't neglect the simple things. I think most new bhikkhus, they know about contemplating food when one's eating. They know that one should try to be mindful here and there when one's walking or when one's doing things. And they think, oh, those are just the simple things, you know. The thing is, they're not. These things are very, very important. And although contemplating food may seem to give no results, steadily over time, they do give results. It does give results. One gets results from it. Another thing I would say for new bhikkhus, one of the things very hard to control is raga tanha, sex. Now, probably the most effective way of controlling this is contemplation of the body. If one finds that raga tanha is arising, anything's wrong, contemplate the body. I mean, traditionally there's 32 parts. But anyway, see the asupa side of it. See the thing as a mess. See it as though it's all broken up. Think of corpses, that sort of thing. Now you find, although you won't see, you won't feel in yourself any special result, you find that the raga tanha has dropped. There's a very good test to this. You watch your dreams. When one has a lot of raga tanha, the tendency is to dream of women and all the rest of it, you know. When you do this contemplation, the women don't come near you in dreams. You may see them, but they won't come near you. It's quite interesting, the effect it has. And it's almost as though it's pushing you away in some way. I don't know quite how. I think this can work physically with women as well. If women are coming too close and becoming rather nuisance, just contemplate the body. Think of them as a lot of bones and flesh and mess and blood and so on, you know, shit and so on, all the rest of it. And you find that they're repulsed. This is a protection that people should have. Because women are very unstable and unpredictable, many of them, some of them, not all of them, some of them. And one needs some protection. And that's an important one.
Yeah, I've had problems with that. Old girlfriends and things just kind of keep coming back. And
yeah.
Just kind of pop into my head. Is there any kind of pattern to when one has?
Well, if the girlfriends come into one's head, okay, cut a head off. See the blood coming. Pull the meat off. Look at the bones. Yeah. And the thing is, you'll find a repulsion from doing that. Think, oh, I mustn't do it with her. Why not? Not harming them. It's just in their own mind. All it's doing is it's doing some damage to the image one has of her. That's all. Don't harm her at all. So that's probably the best way to deal with that one. But one has to make a determination to do it. And if one just sort of lets it come up and one doesn't make a determination, it won't have any effect. The thoughts will just go on in that direction.
That's a problem I've had. I don't know if it's typical of new bhikkhus, but I seem to have these kind of emotional cycles. I mean, like some days are just fine. For a week it'll be just beautiful, and then bang, I don't know what happens. And then
yeah.
And just kind of whatever good results I seem to have, they just kind of seem to...
Yeah, this is how it goes, one's unstable. I have found that these patterns often follow the weather changes. You may watch the weather, and the thing is, then you can predict and you can see, oh, that's what the reason for this. Another thing that can cause them is food. Different types of food sometimes, but often just too much. Too much food causes trouble with practice. A lot of people here go on fast. If you do try fasting, and if you find it effective, then use it. But use it with caution. What I mean by that is, don't go to excessive lengths of fasting. It's not good. Generally, Tamachan, when he used to practice doing this and fasting and so on, he said he used to go for about a week. He wouldn't go more than about a week without eating. Sometimes he went a week without eating, then ate one day, then went another week, and ate one day, and another week, and like that. But he was very difficult. And it seemed to me that what he did there was a very reasonable approach. Otherwise, you get people who can almost get addicted to fasting. And that isn't a good thing. Another thing you get with people who fast, they start competing. Somebody's doing a fast and they think, I'm going to go longer than him. And then, in fact, that is contrary to the way of winning. It's wrong. It's wrong in winning. Because it's doing it for the wrong reason. Fasting should be for the reasons of developing one's practice, not for any other reason. But fasting doesn't suit everyone. No good for me. I tried it. I just lost all energy. The practice went worse. So I don't.
Yeah, I tried different fasts for, you know, from about 2 days to 4 or 5 days.
Yeah.
I could do it. It wasn't much of a problem. I was kind of amazed. It wasn't so difficult, but I can't say I had any particular benefits.
Yeah.
If anything, I felt a little conceited that I could do that.
Yeah. Well, if you don't find it of any benefit, then don't use it. But what's probably quite a good thing to do is to just test it every now and then. Every several months, just try about 4 or 5 days and fast and see if it does have an effect. Probably that's quite a good way to do it.
What is the goal of fasting Tanajin Panyan? What should one expect at the best?
It clears the mind. It prevents the digestion of food being a kind of load on the mind. There isn't a tendency to sleep. One tends to be more mindful. The mind is generally much brighter. One feels lighter and feels more like one wants to do the practice. General ways that it goes with fasting, it goes properly. And one should use that time to try and develop the practice, to try and get as much experience in it as one can. In Thailand, there are many people now who say, oh, the way of samadhi and all the things connected with it, they're unnecessary. What you must have is vipassana, they call it. Now, all I can say is don't listen to them. Tan Chang was once asked about people who talk about vipassana like this. And the questioner said to him, a lay person, is this genuine vipassana or what is it? So he said, well, so there are some people who are thieves. And they say that they are honest, good people. But even though they say they're honest, good people, they still remain thieves. And he said it's like that. He said that they talk about saying it's vipassana, but in fact it's samatha. However much they say it's samatha, it still remains vipassana. And instead of however much they say it's vipassana, it still remains samatha. Because they're doing things like breathing practices. And more the one on the belly here, belly movement practice. That's not a good question. It's samatha. It's calm. And it's samadhi practice.
This vipassana practice that's very popular in Bangkok is the Burmese sort of vipassana that you can practice almost anywhere. But supposedly with a good teacher you can attain sotapanna in two weeks or 3 weeks.
The only thing is, if that was the case, why, in fact, doesn't one see so much of the results of it? I mean, I can't see that the people who practice that are any better than any other people. Whereas the Achans that I've met, who I know to be real Achans, they are different. And they show it. But there's no ostentation about it. I mean, they just show it in their character and their bearing. The general feel you have about them, the way they talk, and so on. You see they're different. But the people who practice this, I don't see them. That's all I can say. I mean, they may like to call themselves by so-called, but personally, I don't believe it. I don't think they know what Sitapana means.
According to some teachers in Bangkok, if you look down the an average street, you should, if you had the power, you could see that, you know, you could see maybe a dozen Sotapannas walking around.
Yeah,
they're very
yeah,
common.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Another thing that kind of seems like the, from the bhikkhus I've seen, is there's a kind of a longer term cycle too, is that after 3 or 4 years and everything seems to, you know, suddenly seem that it's, one hasn't progressed.
You can reckon that there are some bhikkhus go 15 years and they then give up the road. Some more than that. 20, I mean, there's no length, no time limit, really. But then, all you have to do is look at many of the bhikkhus that you see in Bangkok, and you have to reckon up, have these people really got anywhere? And some of them are there 25 years practice, 25 years in the Sangha and so on. See, hang on, all these people. They're nowhere at all. And when a person's like that, if the kilesas arise, they arise, and they give up the road. So, there's nothing to hold it. This is why I said it's so important to get at least some experience of samadhi. You've got to get something to begin with, quite early. And one should really consider that one's got to work hard until one gets some experience. After that, all right, one knows then what one's sort of direction might go. And one can see the value of it. And then there's something at least then to hold on to the Sangha with, unless one gets that, there's nothing.
I find it very difficult to keep samadhi. I mean, now and then in meditation I can reach it, and then it's, everything is very good for a while, and then it just kind of dissipates. And
yeah.
I go back to talking and usual kind of mindless way.
Yes. Probably the reasoning behind this is lack of sadhā, actually. One can't link that samadhi to anything. It's difficult for Westerners because they haven't been brought up in Buddhism. They haven't got the sadhā as a background. Because that's not easy. Thai is a bit easier in that way. They've got to get samadhi, then they can link it back to the Buddha and so on. So, whole background of Buddhism. But still, I mean, that one can't do anything about that in the situation I'm in. The only thing one can do there, really, I think, is if one finds it all drops away, one's then got to continually make a new resolve to get back. One knows it's worthwhile, one knows it's good. And one's got to get back.
This lack of satta is one problem seems Westerners have. Are there other problems that Westerners have in particular?
Yeah, dithimana, opinionatedness, is very bad in Westerners, generally. Very strong. mainly because in the West we're all taught everybody should have opinions, and because of that everybody's an expert on everything. And you can't mention a subject without somebody says, oh, I know what that's all about. You know, they've got no idea at all. they go give out their opinions on it. So, this is a very prevalent thing. One has to be very careful about getting on. There's a very distinct difference between what is opinionatedness and what is knowledge coming from wisdom. Opinionatedness tends to jump to conclusions without having many facts, without knowing the background. Whereas the wisdom searches the whole field and looks in the whole way around it and sees the background of the whole thing and sees cause and effect and how causes work, and because of that there's knowing that everything works, whatever it is. And that way the views are not vittimana, not conceited opinions. Conceited opinions are just usually just taking one facet of it and jumping to conclusions on that one facet without knowing the rest of it.
Yes, I know that.
Well, we all do that, I think. But the Westerners are very prone to it. You think in America it's like. I mean, I remember on the radio in England we used to. We get somebody who was, say, an expert on football, and he'd be interviewed by this man. Now, I wonder what you think about the very present political situation. And then this man had launched forth on it, and he knew nothing about it at all. Complete nonsense, I don't know.
And if I find I have a problem, you know, just when I know I should keep my mouth shut, you know.
Yeah. It's very important to try and know the kilesas. Kilesas are the enemy, and one should know the enemy. Because by knowing the enemy, one can become aware of where he's likely to attack. And one can come to know what are the defences. The first thing to realise is the kilesas are always there. It isn't as though they're sometimes there and sometimes not, they're always there. There's no time when they're not. Until one can say that one's citta is completely ruled by the kilesas. It's under the sway of them the whole time. And the kilesas give rise to the idea of something which we call self. And this something which we call self is really the sort of almost the essence of the kilesas. And we relate everything to this that we call self. And the very relating of that is the kilesas acting as well. And the outlooks we get are all in relation to self. And these outlooks are the kilesas as well. Everything is coloured by them. Everything's distorted. Because of that, we're completely subsumed by these things. And we don't know them, we don't see them, because they're just part of us, completely natural. And we've got to realize that these are here all the time, these things. We mustn't think that they're light things, that they're things that don't matter very much. You think of the evil that some people do. I mean, the Nazis in Germany, the Japanese in China in the war and so on. And the people like the PLA, the Palestinians, and, you know, the rest of them. You don't have to think very far now to see it. All this comes from the kilesas. And it's the kilesas that drag one into the greatest suffering as well. They drag one into doing things which bring one suffering, and they cause one trouble the whole time. They lead one to birth, sometimes good, but sometimes bad too. So they're no small thing. And they're very sticky. They don't go easily. And they're always defensive. One has to realize that they use the power and the skill of the human citta. That is why they're so clever. Because they're using the citta. Not that they're the kilesas in themselves who've got any special cleverness, but they are a sort of distortion of the citta, and they use the citta to think up their own ends. And these are the enemies. They're not an easy enemy to deal with. One has to learn to know it, first of all. You must know them, see them in action. Generally one can't see them when they're acting because one's too caught by them. One should reflect. and see how they made one do this, how they made one do that, how they came out in this way. All the time, okay. At first one can't see the difference between what I'll call oneself and the kilesa. But in time, one does begin to realize that there is a difference there. That the kilesas are one thing, and chitta is another. They're not the same. But the kilesas have usurped the chitta. And what they have produced is what one calls oneself, and this is an imposter. Not the genuine thing at all. The one that is genuine is very hard to realize. But the one that's genuine is like non-self. It's like as though it's not oneself at all. And this one is not false. This one can call it the true chitta, or you can call it dhamma, or whatever it is. And this is the one I'm searching for. I'm searching really to become that. But that means that one's got to learn to be able to give up this that we call self. And that's hard work. One's got to, in fact, train oneself until one comes to the position when one can do that. Until one comes to the position that one can do it, there's no hope of giving it up. You can't just say, I'll give it up now, because it's the kilesas saying that. And the kilesas, all they do is they give up one thing and take another. I mean, usually they say, usually what happens, somebody who tries to sort of do it before it's time, they give up self, and then they take up the idea, I'm an arahant, or something like that. And in fact, all they've done is they've made another self. They just give it the word arahant instead. So they're worse off, because they think then there's nothing more they have to do. And they've got this view, this opinion, which leads them in the wrong way all the time. So those people, if they can't shake that, they're finished. So the kilesas are a bad enemy, and in fact, they are really the only enemy. One can say that whenever anything goes wrong, if the practice doesn't seem to go right, the kilesas are doing it. They're the ones. Often, they are kind of dragging one down so that one can't think straight. One can't make any resolution. And if you look, the thing they get hold of mostly is feeling. Just plain physical feeling, usually around about the stomach here, solar plexus. This is all, it's just that feeling. If one says, can make a resolve and say, to hell with these feelings, I'm going to do the practice, regardless of these feelings. Not anyone can defeat them. But you've got to keep on defeating them time after time. Not just once. So I must learn steadily, bit by bit, to come to know these kilesas. They're very important.
A few times I've seemed to sometimes have a little understanding of just how deep the kilesas go, and then in periods of doubt I just wondered, you know, is there anything besides kilesas? Sometimes it just seems like there'd be nothing left without them. They're so powerful.
Yeah.
Something at least I couldn't imagine.
What you have to see, though, is the kilesas are powerful, but we still have the possibility of choice. And in any situation which arises, one's likely to have the possibility of choosing to go in the right direction or the wrong direction. Now, the right direction has still got kilesas in it, but it's leading to less kilesas and thinning of them. It's leading in the right direction to get free from them. But if one goes in the wrong direction, they're getting thicker. And the kilesas usually try to bias it in the way that you'll go the wrong direction. But one still has the choice. to deliberately go in against them, to go in the right direction. One hasn't got rid of the kilesas by that, but one's going in the direction to get rid of them, that's all. I mean, morality is that, really. Whenever any problem in morality arises, to go in the right direction is going in the direction of reducing the kilesas. It's difficult because the kilesas don't want one to go in that direction. They pull. Because the enticement of the kilesas is so often merely that of relaxation, feeling relaxed at ease, which we want so much. Whereas going against the kilesas produces tension, irritability, and one sort of feels annoyed, generally out of sorts, you know, get constipated and all the rest of it. But the thing is, you're going against the kilesas and one's going in the direction to get rid of them. And all these sort of things like irritability and so on, these are the kilesas trying to pull one back. More technically, we can say these are merely the results of bad karma in the past, which arise, and because of the nature of the kilesas, the arising of these feelings tend to induce one to go on the habitual path of going downhill, where one shouldn't go, to try and get rid of these feelings, these unpleasant feelings. The trouble is, if one goes that direction, one reinforces the karma that will produce those feelings in the future. So the wheel rolls on. So one's really got the choice all the time of whether to go in the right direction or the wrong direction. That's what it all comes to. If one continually chooses the right direction deliberately, one not only starts thinning the kilesas, but one gets the power and the strength of will to go against them more easily. One gets more strength. Whereas if one goes with them all the time, one just ends up a jellyfish. Or completely under this way.
How does one begin to know that one's efforts are having an effect on reducing the kilesas? Is there some, especially
yeah,
for beginners?
One finds, I would say, that one's own estimation of one's self-importance, I don't mean in theory, but one's feeling of it, becomes greater. In the sense, I mean by self-importance, I don't mean in a bad sense, but I mean one's own worth in oneself, quite regardless of what anyone else thinks. But one's own worth in oneself, one doesn't feel that one's just like an old foot rag. Inside one feels one's got something that's valuable. And that thing of value starts growing. And one finds also then that there's firmness inside. There's a firmness which is capable of fighting the kilesas, of going against them. I mean, all these things they do show externally, but the external thing isn't what matters. Yeah? That's just a byproduct. It's the internal thing that matters all the time.
Well, I've had feelings of self-importance at times, but it's more in the sense of conceit, I think.
Yeah, I don't mean self-importance where one's thinking about how important one is. It's just a feeling without... One almost sort of wonders, well, why do I feel like this? You know, what sort of feels, well, I feel like this, but is it a genuine thing or not? But at the same time, it's there. And even though one questions it, it doesn't go. So, you know it's genuine. I mean, if one has the usual meaning of self-importance in the world, if one questions that and investigates it, it just bursts out of the bubble. Okay. Because nothing to support it at all.
You mean that one kind of has a sense that the way that one is going is the right way, and that one has a kind of a...
Yeah. Although one may not be able to see what way one's going quite. Or may not know what specific things one's done to go that way, which specific things have helped us. Yet at the same time, one knows that one's developed. And one can hardly put one's finger on it. It's very hard to say what it is. The development has taken place, and one knows it. One knows one's changed. One used to be like that, and one's no longer like that. Mm.
Other times I have kind of a sense of impatience that things aren't working fast enough, and maybe it's time to fast or to...
Another Western trait.
Sit up all night and
yeah.
Try to do battle with the
Chinese. Yeah.
It doesn't seem to work either.
Like you see in the magazines, you know. Rush me a copy of your catalogue. Impatience. Can't wait for it.
That's one thing I noticed at Wat Pa Ananya Chat, is that it's almost kind of a frightening sense of just kind of willpower, sheer willpower, that people are going to kind of have results immediately. And it seems kind of admirable in a way, but a little frightening in another way.
Yeah. That's no good. The more one tries to push it in that way, the more the obstacles come up against it. Because that is curiosity. The thing is, it's I'm going to get results, the emphasis on I. And I'm going to force the results regardless, you know. Now, if that's under the control of a really good teacher, you might be able to use that faculty, that power. But when it's under the person's own control, generally what happens is this. If a person has a number of ways they can go, they will only see one or two of these ways. They will not see the others. And the way they should go is the ways they don't see. Because that's the way where their kilesas are, most of the way, or where they're strongest. Because of their character. Because of that, they don't see that way, they only see this way. And this is the way where their articulation is not very strong. So they always go lopsidedly developing those things which they've already got quite strong. And the things where they really need development, they can't see. And they go, no, don't go that way. Typically, this works. The people who are greedy characters always think they hate characters. The people who are hateful characters always think they're very greedy. The reason for this is the person who is a greedy character, it's so much part of his nature, you don't see it. Whereas when hate arises, it almost sticks out like a sore thumb. It's obvious to him. So he thinks his character is rooted in hate. So he thinks, I must do the things to control hate. Whereas that's not the one. Agreed with each other. The way it works. This is one of the reasons why it's very difficult for people to develop Dhamma on their own without a teacher. Because one way or another the teacher will indicate the general direction one should go. And Tanachan here is very skilled at it. He rarely tells somebody you should do this practice or you should do that practice. Very rare. He'll suggest a range of practices, but one way or another he'll do things or indicate things or say a little bit here, a little bit there, and gradually steer the person one way or another. He's very good at that. But he won't, as far as it's within Dhamma, he won't force the person. So
more in depth one's practiced. I mean, it seems like you can see that many people are different characters. I mean,
yeah.
Not just kind of superficial characters, but they have very deep kind of tendencies. Can one adapt that oneself, or does one really need a teacher to? Because, you know, like, for example, as for myself, I just can see the certain things that I could never do. Like, I could never become a great teacher. I know that for sure. Certain things. I mean, I just know my character, and I just wonder how one can use that in one's practice.
As to whether you could ever become a great teacher, that you don't know.
Well, yeah.
Because the thing is that what you are at the moment probably couldn't become a great teacher. Well, that's the calculations clear away, one changes entirely. And one just doesn't know what one's going to become. Got no idea. It's something utterly different from what one ever expected. In fact, usually when results come in practice, they come in a way which one never thought of. Mm-hmm. Something completely out of the blue. And the way one has expected the results to come, if they come that way, they're not very much.
Do you think it wise, Ajahn, for a new bhikkhu to stay in with the first teacher for 5 years?
Yeah. Good. 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 But I would say that it's not good to take the attitude. I somehow, I'm going to stay with the teacher for 5 years regardless. And I don't think about doing the practice properly. Mm-hmm. I've got to think about staying with the teacher for 5 years as being a period where one learns the practice and learns what's necessary to be learned so that one can, if one wants to, go away on one's own. And to go away on one's own doesn't mean that so many now think it means to go back to Bangkok. But, go to the forest or to a pretty quiet place to practice meditation. It should be. One of the troubles now, of course, is that the way of the world has invaded the monasteries as well. And the bhikkhus who become, well, people who become bhikkhus now, often they are people who have been to school or to sometimes university. And they're completely infected with the sort of Western traditions and ways of the world. And they haven't got what I would call a sort of proper feeling for religion. It's a difficult thing to describe, really. It means a sort of outlook where one sees the religion as being the important thing and not the way of the world. In other words, I mean, people who think in terms of the way of the world, they think in terms of expediency, how one should behave in the world. What are good manners in the world, that one should have knowledge of the way that people think and act in the world and all the rest of it. Whereas the way of religion isn't that at all, it's the way of what is true, what is correct, what is leading to freedom. It doesn't like the sham of the world. And it, you know, the whole thing is an attitude which is quite different from that of the worldly attitude. And one sees people in the world and although one may feel sorry for them, one may feel one would like to help them, at the same time one also feels a bit disgusted with the way they do things, the way they act with them. It's rather like that. And in fact, even good people find that they don't know why people are And I see that the things they're interested in, the things that they do, the things the way they act and so on, they laugh and make a joke of it. I don't know. This sort of thing is very important to you, the right attitude. And this is the thing when, I don't know, maybe it's just not becoming true. It may probably grow as a practice as well. I mean, this sort of attitude is not confined only to Buddhism. You get this in other ones, I'm sure, in Christianity, things like that. But only amongst those who practice. And nowadays, you might find it hard to find it in Christianity as well. I think you would.
I suppose it might be a little more difficult for older people who ordain a little later in life, you know, to spend much of the time in the world.
Yes,
I know. Might be more difficult to give up than ordain very young.
I remember in what Bourne once summed up, used to give his weekly talks, and I heard about what he asked me to give talks about him. Mrs. Stanton, you know, pretty well now. She's a grey-haired old lady. She used to be the wife of the American ambassador.
Joseph Stanton?
Really smart, yeah. She said, well, you know, don't you think it's better if people live in the world and then when they're old they become ordained and become vicars and whatever it wants to be like that, you see? I said, well, the Buddha said that you shouldn't wait until the hairs on your head are all grey before you should come on. Of course, hairs are all grey, as ain't. I don't feel like it.
I wonder if they shouldn't become bhikkhus first and then to go out into the world. Can't have an effect.
Yes. I don't know. My own feeling in Thailand is that it's too easy to become Buddhist. The ordination is far too easy. And a person can become like a general fellow, become a monk for just a week. I mean, I don't know if there's really so much point in it. I mean, it's good to be like, I think he has sadhana, and probably for him it's a very good thing, but I'm not sure it's good for his family. It makes it far too easy just to go get into the road and get out of it again. For me, it sort of brings the value of it down.
Quite cheapens.
Yeah. I mean, it's traditional here, we can't do anything about it, can't we? But I think if ever we do anything worse, nothing looking difficult. At least to the person who has to have some sort of probation for time.
Well, I think so. I spent my first trains at what they want, this last train. So
yeah.
The population there is normally about 50 or 60 bhikkhus in some seminaries. And during the rains they had about 120 new bhikkhus, twice as many new bhikkhus as old.
Yeah.
This had an incredible effect on the atmosphere.
Yeah.
It just changed things completely. And
yeah.
I found myself talking with the new bhikkhus about all sorts of worldly things because that's all they knew.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm too young to be able to talk anything but that. And so it had quite an effect on me.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it again. I don't think I'd recommend any new bhikkhus to spend too many rains like that.
No, I don't think it's very good to. It's good for the bhikkhus people being ordained and all like that, yes. But I have to think of the Sangha also, the effect on other bhikkhus. And it's not very good having too many coming in at the time, really. But when you have new bhikkhus coming in a large number at a time, there's a tendency for them to form a group separate from the others. Most of them. And that's not very good either.
Not that admire the old bhikkhus in a way for staying away from them, because probably they're best people.
Yeah.
The new bhikkhus didn't gain very much from that, to me.
Yeah.
They went to classes, and that was about it.
Yes.
Otherwise, I don't think they satisfied their parents.
Yeah. I haven't said what your own answer is. But I don't go to Bangkok anymore. No.
I was told by every single people I met, you know, don't stay in Bangkok, don't stay there. I thought, well, I'll study. I've got a good library and I'll study.
Mm.
I'll get a good foundation in the books. And, you know, I can't say that I gained much of anything.
Now, the thing is, I don't say the books are no use. They're quite valuable. But I'm probably using the right way. And the right way, really, is just something to pop up one's practice when it's necessary. What I mean by that is that if one is, particularly when one's doing wisdom practice, one's doing a lot of investigating, then one looks in the book and searches out the things or what it says and one sees and one, you know, they can give one hints as to what one to look, what to look for. They can point out things, you know, and perhaps on some sentence or other will set one thinking and I start sort of working on that, and that's quite a good object of Dhamma to having one's mind. The books can be quite useful like that, because they're reminders of things, you know, storehouses of potentials that one can bring up in oneself. But when we're doing samadhi, Tamachan told us how when he first went to Tamachan Mun, previously he had been a bhikkhu for several years and he learned Pali up to Maha grade, I don't know which one. But he said he could read Pali in the book, you know. And his teacher of Pali wants him to go on to Pali 9 or something. But anyway, he decided he wants to go away to practice. So he left and went off to Kauras, and then he went to Tamachan Mun. And Tamachan Mun said to him that he read a lot and he learned a lot of the books. But all this you must forget. You know, later on he said it would be quite useful to him. But at the moment you put them all aside, forget the whole lot. And it won't help you at all. Later, when you've developed, then you can bring, all this can help you quite a lot. And it will come back and help you. And he said it was like a Buddha. Because the books are really dealing with the analysis of the way, bringing up things here and there, what you should do, what you know, and so on. Shows you all done with it. And all this is the right wisdom. And until I develop calm, I want to ask to use that, I want the proper wisdom. Because one has to know the nature of wisdom. Wisdom is not thinking about, just like that. The thinking about can lead to wisdom, if one has a basis of calm. For without the calm, thinking about it just destroys the thought, and all it does is produce restlessness. So, what one has to do is really get the basis of calm to start with. There are a few people who can do it directly from the way of wisdom, start on that, but they're rare, dread finding one like that. But there's something in the way of Zen, in the way they do it, they're starting with, in the way of wisdom. And samadhi can develop from that. But the majority of people can't do it. And they've got to be able to work calm. They've got to calm down. Get down, through, get the start going quiet, calm. And then they'll find at times wisdom, they can turn to something. Chitta, quite unlike restless thinking, it goes deep in like that, and the one thing, deep and sort of slowly works over the thing. While it's working over it, it sees the whole thing absolutely clear, you know, quite clear. And it goes deep into it. Mm-hmm. Not just on the surface, just skittering about on a monkey. Quite different. And the feeling is quite different. It's a feeling from the heart, really. And it's very satisfying, very, very, very cooling, very firm, and then sort of firm platform. Another thing that's worth realizing is the nature of calm. Calm is not, most people get a bit muddled up with calm. Dharachan, as we said, sometimes when people listen to a desana given by an acharya, if you could have good acharya, the person who listens to that, state of calm can develop just by listening to it. And then the person feels like going to sleep, feels sort of drowsiness and sort of strange thoughts and things come up and doesn't know quite where they come from, they just come like this. And one looks on them as distractions. And Tarchan said, when this happens, most people are going, oh, I must just end up bringing her to go back. He said, why? Because when one gets a bit of calm, one doesn't notice. One then tries to break it all up. He said that that's how this state of calm is valuable. If you let it be there, one shouldn't try and remember what one's doing. Just let it go in. If it goes in, it's been understood when one just heard it. It'll stick there. After the day's now, one won't remember a single word of what one's heard, probably. It doesn't matter, because it's all there. And at the right time, that can come up. But this state of calm is important. It's the sort of feeling almost as though must go to sleep. And it's as though the chitta is sort of just drifting a little bit like this. And then you get, often you get sounds coming up, and, well, different people get different things, you might get mimicry sounds. And the skill of practice is to get to that state and to prevent it from actually going to sleep. And to keep it on the edge. So the mindfulness is necessary. To recognize it, not to get restless and pull it out, but not to let it go too deep so that it goes into sleep. No one can keep it on that way. This is the trouble. People don't know, really, any of these things we hear about, samadhi and so on, there are experiences in ordinary life which are close to it. Samadhi, wisdom also, are experiences in ordinary life which are close to it. People don't recognize them because they don't know what they're looking for. I don't know, have you ever had the experience of being drowsy and then sort of all sorts of things come up? hear the sounds, such, and then just take notice of them without any actively serious, internally, one's quite calm and clear and unaffected. And you think all just come up and you find that sometimes. That's good. That's a state to develop that. Getting to that, just hold it there and hold it. But if a lot of limiters come up, don't take too much notice of them. Don't get too interested. Just keep on gently holding the practice at that level. You find that interesting, because most it'll break the practice up. Sometimes, particularly if they're frightening, one gets absorbed, one gets completely concentrated. And that's bad, because it's unpleasant. And then fear can come up, really bad. Others can go mad. But one must see that all limiters, all sounds, are mere sounds and mere images. None of them are harmful. The harm comes from fear. That's the danger. Fear is the danger. If one ever gets fear coming, it's the fear that's the danger, not anything else. Like so many people don't realize, it's common place in the West to think about somebody who sees all sorts of things like that and hears things that they're mad. What people don't realize is that's not madness. After all, if you see these things, you see them, after all. Much like you look at that thing, you can see it, it's there. What is madness if you then believe that Jesus Christ is in the vessel? That is madness. One's beliefs and one's thoughts which make one mad, not the images in which it comes.
But then certain types of people seem to have limits, and certain types of people seem to go crazy from that. Is it just that people cling to them? Is that
Often, sometimes they get. One of the limiters may be a Red Indian chief, you see, and then they just start telling him things. So I believe it, you know, he tells him the right things to do, so I must do what he says, so they follow him, so he tells him. And maybe to start with, he tells them things that are right. But sure enough, later on, he'll be telling you things that are just pure philosophy coming up. This is merely just a trick of the chitta to get down to that level. And I mean, if the person gets whatever the Red Indian chief or whatever it happens to be, if they get this coming up, and they take it with a surprise, they don't know what it is, it'll probably be genuine. But once they start getting interested, they go, oh, I wonder if you can tell me the lottery number. And I'll get asked that. And all right, the lottery number comes up, it's probably wrong. The thing is, once their interest comes up, Kalesha's come up too. In other words, this thing has bypassed the kilesa because of lack of interest, because of feeling something separate, not me. But when one wants something, the kilesa is immediately there all the time, so in the end, that's such a standing, it all goes off. No, the general rule, to begin with, if limiters come up, images, whether they're limiters of sight or sound or anything, don't pay any attention to them. They come or what they come, they go or what they go, don't be interested in them, don't think about them, just keep on doing practice, gently, okay. That's what I think.
They don't mean anything besides their limits themselves. There's nothing.
No.
That's significant in what they are.
No. Tanakaman told Tanakaman once that when he was doing his practice, he had a period early on in his practice when he had Nimitas coming up, and he said that he used to practice every night and Nimitas coming up and go on. Oh, it's lots of things coming, one after another, after another. He went on like this for about 6 months or so. Then in the end, he thought, I've been doing this for 6 months, and I don't see what I've gained any at all. So he stopped. He refused to do it anymore, and he turned to investigating the body. Body concentration. And he gained his loss. But they come up like this, and sometimes you can learn something from them. I mean, particularly if they're ministers of the body. But mostly they're just junk from the past. So sometimes you might see things with the psyche, and you might see something at a distance, or you might see something that happens tomorrow. Or, sometimes it's just chance. That's what it is. To get interested in that, and to try and get control of it, is all wrong. We've got enough faculties already as human beings without bothering about cutting ourselves with more. We can't even use it in a process. If one starts getting sort of into a psychic field, that's a field for delusion, there's no doubt about it. It can drive people mad, because of their views, their opinions, their conceit that they can do, and the constant searching for this without any reason behind the search, you know, what's the point of it? Well, if you psychic powers, they're there, and they do work, but so well and good, and one knows about them. But one's not after them, what one's after is sukha. You overcome the dukkha. And the freedom which one can get by practicing the way. We want the freedom. And moreover, the sticky things, if one gets into them, it's difficult to let go of. Another thing about them, nearly all of them are external, out in the world. Practically everyone. Whereas the right way of Dhamma is not in the world, but going inward. Not out. There was a Meiji who came to Tanakaman. This woman, who had quite natural powers, she would know people were coming to watch before they arrived. And she could sense quite often, see things that were going to happen, and so on, and so on. Anyway, she told Tanakaman said, oh, that's really good, that's good. Said, but can you get inside? See inside as well. So, oh, I know, can't do it. She said, well, you can try, see if you can do it. She went away, and after the Baratish came back, I can't do this. Tanakaman said, you must. It's no good just having one side, you've got to get the other side as well. You've got to go outside, you've got to go inside. No good just seeing what's outside, but you must know what's inside as well. She went away and still couldn't do it. So he said, right, you go away, you've got to get inside. You can't come and see me again till you get inside. Go away. So anyway, she went, I've got to get inside. So eventually she managed to get down there. And then came to Tanakaman and said, I understand. She said, all that outside is worthless. It's the single thing that matters. He goes, I don't understand. But he didn't tell her straight away that it was useless. He just said, well, you've got to get inside as well. And she did. Okay, well, but this woman she was one of those who was quite psychic. And she could do that little thing. Most people can't.